Okay, good evening, Erev Tov. Firstly, we have to dedicate the shiur in honor of Moshe Rabbeinu, Zayin Adar, which is the traditional yahrzeit. He was born and died on Zayin Adar, so it's one of those days which, if you're of the Hasidic persuasion, then you are not going to say Tachlin tomorrow and various other things that people do.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. Traditionally around the world, and it's kind of interesting, the Chevra Kedisha would have some sort of Seuda or some sort of gathering on Zayin Adar, which was tradition, except in the Yekis. With the German community, they did it on, they moved it to Kristallnacht, because for Germany it was obviously that was a date that became very significant. So the German community in Breuers and London in the Munkschule do their dinners on they get together on that particular date. But around the world, Zayin Adar is always a date of remembering that event. Good evening. Just grab a sheet on your way in. I also want to dedicate this year in honor of someone who just recently passed away. A Rebbe of mine taught me 30 years ago when I was studying Rabbi Riskin's yeshiva in Moshav Elazar, one of his first projects in Israel. And we had a teacher called Yaakov Moshe Pupko. The Pupko family is well known.
My
related.
Rabbi in Rochester mentioned him.
Right, and Rabbi Yaakov Moshe passed away 2 days ago. And a friend of mine in London, who was a very close Talmud for over 30 years, is absolutely distraught. And we're not sure what happened. It seemed to have been very sudden. The story with the Pupko family is that the Chofetz Chaim is, although we know him as Yisroel Meir Kagan, he adopted the name Pupko. And I remember that Rabbi Pupko spoke about it and said that what happened was that the Chofetz Chaim was his parents died very young, I guess, and he was adopted by the Pupko family. So his name was actually Yisroel Meir Kagan Pupko. That really was his name. And that was the connection between the Chofetz Chaim and the Pupko family, and they're really all over the United States and Eretz Yisrael. He was a very special man, a bit of an eccentric, as the family tends to be, but at the same time, a major Talmid Chacham, and someone who really was a very, how should we say, he wasn't appreciated when he should have been. He was someone who really did have phenomenal knowledge, so we'll dedicate the shiur in his memory. May his memory be for a blessing. This evening, T, we're getting through the alphabet, my goodness. Before I forget, I'm going to forget to say this at the end, we now have to have a break, because we've got, next week is obviously Purim, 2 weeks time there's the lecture for the school, Malcolm Honlein, which I hope everyone is going to attend. That's always worth hearing. If you haven't heard him on the radio, go along, because he's always got something interesting to say. He's just been in the United Arab Emirates on behalf of the American Conference of Presidents. You know, it's a whole thing. Very interesting gentleman. Never met him, but listened to him on a regular basis, and therefore we're breaking for 2 weeks. After that, I'm pretty sure that we're in the Pesach season, so I'm not sure whether we'll do anything now till after Pesach, but we will put out an announcement because we're having a break now. We get to March 14th, and Pesach's already, 28th? The P word.
Must break.
I
gladly come to escape my household.
Yeah, it may not work out time-wise, so this might be the last session before Pesach, but I hope we'll have one or two sessions after Pesach. We've got the 70th anniversary of the State of Israel coming up, so we're going to do something on Zionism. These are important things. For this evening, triage, one of my favorite shiurim, because I've spoken about this many times. And it's one of those things that you set out the problem and then you try and sort of fit it in to the source material that we have. And the basic problem is that as a community we have limited resources. We're always being told this, right? There is a limited amount of money. The demands are endless, right? As we all know, be it for schools, be it in Eretz Yisrael, you're talking about hospitals, you're talking about community infrastructures and all the rest of it. And the question is, how do you decide, how do you prioritize? How do you come to any sort of decision about what comes first? You'll see here, I've got three in fact, three source papers put together. This shiur normally takes 2 hours, and I'm going to sort of condense it a little bit this evening into the main points. And there's two chidushim, as far as I'm concerned, two amazing things that come out of this. Number one is the fact that this is a problem which you find source material in rabbinic literature about it. Right, you would say, you know, what do the rabbis know about these things? But you'd be amazed that the original source material, what it actually refers to. And I think also the very fact that there's going to be some surprises. All right, you know, I would say to you, if you had $1 million and, you know, the once upon a time you could build a hospital for $1 million, or you could build a library for $1 million, and you're in Eretz Israel, and it's a Jewish country, and you have to make a decision, you're the person in charge of that particular fund, I think most of us will say, well, obviously, you know, this is kind of a rule that everybody knows, because nefesh, that it's got to be something that saves lives, and therefore, obviously, you build the hospital. No question about it. And you'll be surprised to know that this is not the agreed answer by a long shot. Before we get to discuss the those types of cases, I just want to show on the front page here. It comes out from these first sources, which I'm not going to go through. I'm going to go through B. But section A, which is talking about Sanhedrin and Bet Din, there seems to already come out a certain sense of a rule, which is not a halachic rule, but it's a rule that we would apply, and the rabbis seem to have been aware of this. And it's the rule that first come, first serve. All right. The idea is that the prioritization goes according to who is in line first, who applied for this first. You have a limited amount of money, you have a number of people who apply, and basically first come, first serve. This is the way, for instance, I know certain grants are given for people. Let's say their students want to go and study in Israel. The funding is kind of limited to help to pay for that particular expense, and the decisions are made. Again, we know one of the guys running one of these funds. It's made on a first-come, first-served basis. And that, again, is not just as a way of dealing with it, as you say, using seichel, common sense, but it actually does come out a little bit from the source material. The rule will be, if we haven't got any real guideline in terms of prioritization, then we can always go back to that principle of first-come, first-served. And I want to show you something where that would apply in a minute. Before we get to that, just one example, or a couple of examples, of when you have to prioritize. You're a shul, and you have to employ a rabbi. I'm going to get very controversial. You have to employ a rabbi and or a chazan. What do you do? Okay? Do you have two people which you can't afford? Or do you have one of them? And if it's going to be one of them, which one is it going to be? Is it going to be the rabbi? Is it going to be the chazan? All right, that's a question which, in many Orthodox synagogues, is a very real problem. Okay, what do you do? Ideally, you get a rabbi who can daven from the omer, who can be the chazan. But it's not always going to work out like that, I can assure you. So what do you do? So have a look at it. This is very surprising. Section 2 on the page. It's the second from last Hebrew quote. Shulchan Aruch. The rabbis knew this was going to be a problem. And you'll be surprised at the answer. They say, Tzibur shetzrichim liskoram ushliat tzibur. The community has to hire a rabbi or and a chazan, shliach tzibur. The ein sipuk biyadam litein l'shneim. There's not enough money to pay for both. Im hu rav muvak. Now you go for the rabbi on one condition, that he's an outstanding rabbi, ubaki b'horaot ubedinim, and he's expert in decisions of Jewish law. I wish I could say that about all the rabbis coming out of Yeshiva University and coming out of Lakewood and wherever they come from. I hope that's true, but I'm not always convinced, because they tend to tell you, well, we've got to call somebody to get the answer. And if not, who could have in la? If your rabbi is not an expert, then shaliach tzibur kodem. You have the chazan first. Isn't that interesting? And I really believe one of the great tragedies in the Orthodox world today, particularly in the Orthodox world, is the fact that chazanim do no longer exist. They really have more or less been phased out of most shuls, and now you walk into a shul, you don't know what the nusach is, and nusach is so precious. You don't know what, they daven Shabbos Mincha as if it's Rosh Hashanah, and Rosh Hashanah as if it's Shabbos Mincha. And before you look around, Friday night, it's got to be Kalbach. Now we can't do Kalbach because all of the issues with Kalbach are coming out again, and people now saying, should we or should we not? And nusach has basically been, for want of a better word, I wouldn't say destroyed, thank God it's not gone completely, but it's now very, very challenged. And you can see from the Shulchan Aruch, Shliach Tzibur, you've got to take into account that the chazan, the person who teaches, not only is your messenger before God, but he teaches the whole community how to lead a service, he has a certain amount of priority. If you're in a situation where it's the chazan or the rabbi and you haven't got money for both, and your rabbi that you can get hold of is not going to be one of the great poskim of the, one of the great deciders in Jewish law, right? It's not going to be one of these guys on the back wall over here. So the reality is, that is quite a surprise, right? And again, I'm very appreciative of the fact that Shulchan Aruch says this, even though it's a bit... Nowadays, I'm not sure whether this is what most shuls would decide. They'll go for the rabbi and hope that he can lane a bit and he can daven a bit. I had that experience in London. I applied as a rabbi and I got a job as a rabbi. It turned out that the expectation was that I would even daven Rosh Hashanah. Oh. Never done it in my life. Daven Shacharis 1 year, Musaf the next year. Don't ask. It was baptism by fire. I suppose that's the wrong expression to use, but you know what I mean. Sorry.
What about Kriyas
HaTorah? Kriyas HaTorah every week. I learned all the parshas in 1 year. I spent 3-4 hours every day schwitzing over that particular thing. It was tough. Okay, I was grateful because they made me learn Megillah, and that's something which I was very happy about. Kriyas HaTorah was tough. I appreciated knowing it, but I didn't appreciate being put in a position where you were told this was what you have to do. It was not easy. If you turn over the page, and again, that's just one example. The over the page is the one which is very, very difficult to explain to you because this is clearly not the way we think today. It's what I call the problem of the Titanic. Who gets off the boat first? The boat is sinking. Never. What is the rule? And this, again, is a Mishnah in Hurri. It's a Mishnah. Look at this at the top of the page, on the back of the sheet that I get, the first sheet. Ha'ish kodem li'isha lachiyot. You've got to put the men first. Wow, that would get a headline in the New York Times immediately. Right? Think about that. The Mepharshim say, look, it's one of those things that... I'm not apologizing for this. It's just the reality. The rabbi said men have more mitzvah to perform. So if you look at it in terms of mitzvah, it's going to be saving the men to perform more mitzvah than saving the women. All right, it's not women and children first, it's men followed by women and children. One second, not completely. It says, when you've got a situation when women are treated before men, that's in a situation, if they are desperate for clothing, and obviously a woman cannot go around unclothed, it's lacking in dignity and modesty and everything else. And you've got two people in jail, and you can get one of them out. One would be a man, one would be a woman. You should try and release the woman before the man. This again is a situation which you'll see in Jewish law was reflected over and over again. The non-Jews used to take Jews and ransom them. Right? The famous story of the Maharam of Rottenburg, the mayor of Rottenburg. This rabbi, it's an unbelievable story. In the 1215 or 1220, whenever it was, he was taken by the non-Jewish thugs, the only way to describe it, and put into jail. And they made a ransom. And they said that, you want your rabbi back, it's going to cost you this, or whatever. And the community started raising the money, because they wanted the rabbi back. He was a very serious... Every page of Gemara has his commentary. Every single page of Gemara. And this was like a really serious rabbi. And the rabbi said, no. He said, I'm not allowing you to redeem me. And they said, Rebbe, but you're going to sit in this jail. You're going to rot in here. He said, no. If you do this now, they'll just come back and grab me again. And there'll be another ransom, and whatever. And he refused. And he died in jail. It's an unbelievable story. What they did do, they realized that they had on their hands a real tzaddik. Because he made the impression, even on the jailers, who were not the greatest people in the world, as you can imagine. and they made his life in there as comfortable as it could possibly be. The main thing was they gave him pen and parchment, and he sat and learned for years and years, writing his commentary on Talmud. That's what he did. Unbelievable story. So again, you know, you're in a situation in Jewish history where these kind of things come up, and the reality of it is that the ransom is a problem. Certainly the Nazis did this in World War II over and over again. If you've seen any recreations of the Warsaw Ghetto, Cherniakov, who was the head of the Warsaw Ghetto Committee, eventually committed suicide because he just couldn't take the pressure. Every time that he was called for a ransom and he got it to the money together, they'd already killed the Jews that he was meant to be ransoming. And it was something that he just couldn't handle, and we should never ever be in that situation. One other example which we all know about, Kohen Levi Yisroel, the Gabbai's dream or nightmare, depending how you look at it. And it's over here, the middle section over here on that page. And we say like this, Kohen Kari Batari Rishon, Acharav Levi V'Acharav Yisroel. Right, you call the Kohen, Levi, and then Yisroel. The Shabbat, the Yontav, Yom HaKippurim, Kohen, Acha Levi. Now, who do you call up for Shlishi? That's who's going to be the Yisroel? All right, now this is really the big deal. And many shuls have had a lot of bust-ups over this, over the years, about the third call-up. You can't help calling up the Kohen, can't help calling up the Levi. But what about Shlishi? And he says, who you should call? This is all Shulchan Aruch. He says, Talmud Chacham, Talmid Chachamim, Memunin al Tzibur. You call up, firstly, the people who run the community. Hopefully, they're scholars as well. Hopefully. V'achareim, Talmid Chacham, Ahmarim, Limnotam, Parnizim al Tzibur. And they're the potential leaders. Right? So you make sure that people know that if you're going to become a leader of the community, you're in line to get Shlishi. Now, for us today, I'm not sure if this is such a big deal, but once upon a time, whoa, this was the covered of covered. Kibudim, Me'alu Me'eved. And he says, Shesholim Oto Dva'alocha, and he says exactly what sort of person it is, that he knows the laws. And if you're still looking for someone to call up, find the children of scholars, she'avoteim umunim al tzibur, who are running the community. V'achakach rashei knesiyot v'chol ha'am, and then everybody else. So to get shlishi is a serious business, and again, you've got to prioritize. It's prioritized in terms of talmidei chachamim. I remember the first time I went to Israel, I stayed with a family in Kiryat Mattersdorf. Mattersdorf was a very frum neighborhood, even in those days. This is 1976. I was there over the Entebbe. Yeah, I'll never forget it. Right? I was in Israel at the time. Quite amazing. And the movie's just coming out again. Another recreation of Entebbe. It's quite amazing. And so we went to shul Friday night, and it's a friend from those days. He's now Rosh Yeshiva somewhere in Yerushalayim. And he said, look at the Mizrach. Every shul used to have in Europe, and they recreated this in Israel, the special seats at the front, what they call the Mizrach seats, right in the front of the shul. And I knew from London, that you would have such an arrangement. Who would be sitting at the front? You'd have the rabbis in the shul, and then you'd have the people with money and people what they call the askonim, you know, the people who are communal, the machas. So he said to me, my friend, he said, look at the front there. You know who's sitting there? That guy, he's the plumber. He says, that guy over there, he fixes washing machines. He says, that guy over there, he's the electrician. And they're sitting at the front. So I'm looking at him saying, you know, that's be very wealthy guys. He said, no, it's nothing to do with wealth. It's to do, in Eretz Yisrael, it's about knowledge. It's about recognition of the fact that they are scholars. They come to the shir every night. They study Gemara, but in the moments when they're not working, they're always learning. These are the values in Eretz Yisrael. It's a very different world. It's a very different world. There's a great story from Reb Steinemann, I don't know if there's a picture of him over here, who passed away recently, that he was approached by an American Oleh Chadash, somebody come to Israel, and wanted to bring a Cadillac to Bnei Brak. He wanted to bring a Cadillac. He was worried. What was he worried about? He was worried about the reaction of the people, right, seeing the guy driving around with a Cadillac. So he went to Reb Steinemann. So Reb Steinemann said to him, he said, listen, he said, you know, how much Gemara do you know by heart? How much Talmud do you know by heart? He said, not really. He said, how many Mishnais do you know by heart? He said, no, not really. No, I learn, but, you know. He said, all right, you know, Chumash Rashi, do you know Chumash Rashi, Balpeh, by heart? He said, no. He said, you know what? He says, nobody's going to be jealous of you in B'nai Brak. You're driving a big car. It's nothing for those guys. If you came in and said you knew the whole of Talmud by heart, then they're going to be jealous. That's B'nai Brak. That's a town which is based on Torah values. It's a great story because it's putting everything into perspective. Whether he brought the car in the end, I don't know. You see Cadillacs in it, or the equivalent today. It's not as incongruous as it was once upon a time. Yeah?
What does
Lekal
Kala mean?
Kal Kala. Oh, we didn't finish this. This is obviously if she's going to be abused. Right, bismajish name amdim the kalkala, they're going to be abused in jail, rape or whatever. Then her ish kodin isha. It's interesting. Then we're worried more about the man than the woman, because the male abuse that can go on is more, I suppose, soul destroying in a way for the man. It's for both. I mean, there's no discussion. But if you're going to weigh up priorities, then you get the man out before the woman, if that is the circumstance in which they find themselves. Which again is a very honest Mishnah. I'm not sure whether we'd be happy with the prioritization that the Mishnah gives. You know, men before women and children on the Titanic. That was the whole thing in the movie. That guy gets off the boat, you know, the horrible guy. I've forgotten who the actor was. You know, the bad guy who managed to escape. Probably did exist in reality, right? Along with Molly Brown and all the rest of them. And it's one of those difficult Mishnayot which sees, essentially, from a Torah perspective, sees things in a very different way. All right, I just wanted to bring these as kind of examples of prioritization, you know, because these are questions which are very relevant. Go over to the next page, and again, I'm not going to go through the thing of charity, because that is incredibly difficult and incredibly important, but just to sort of say very briefly, the Rambam gives 8 levels of tzedakah. It's very famous. The Rambam says that when you're prioritizing who you give the money to, this is the classic thing. You're in the davening in the morning. Again, not so much in this country now. It's sort of more under control, and people come in, you know, at the end of davening if they're coming to collect. But when you're standing, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, even today, and you're trying to do Shema, and you're holding your tzitzis, and you're trying to say the with kavona, and this guy is rattling a tin in front of you, or he wants money. It's the most difficult thing to, you know, there you've got to balance between God and this guy who is in your face, literally in your face. And he won't take no for an answer, even though you can't speak at that moment. It's kind of tough. So the Rambam sort of writes about this in general terms, about prioritization of tzedakah. And I'm just going to read this middle paragraph, because it's fascinating. This is Shulchan Aruch, based on the Rambam. It says, Shmona ma'alot yesh b'tzedakah. Zula ma'alot mizu. There are 8 levels of tzedakah, of charity. Ma'ala gedola she'ein lemala mimenu. You think, what is the greatest level of charity? Is it 1 million or 10 million? Or 20 million. He says, no. Nothing to do with numbers. He says, Ze ha-machazik biyad Yisrael shemach. You support the Jew who's fallen on hard times. And not with money necessarily, but you help him to help himself. You really get him to... he says, V'notin lo matanal hava'ah. You either give him a gift or a loan. O say mo shutfut, or you make a partnership with him. O mamtzi lo malacha, or find him a job. Kedei lechazek et yodo. Until he does not require help from anybody else. That's a phenomenal thing. Mm-hmm. Chief Rabbi Jacobowitz, the Kohen Levroch in London, wrote an article in the Daily Mail in London, one of the big newspapers, and he said this. He quoted this Rambam. And the letters started pouring in. How can the rabbi say that we don't, you know, this is not a Christian way of looking at things. Christianity says, you know, you give money to the poor and you just keep feeding, basically, their habit of getting more and more difficult circumstance. Rabbi Jacobowitz said, no, the best thing you can do is to help the person, to help himself or herself by encouraging them to become self-sufficient. By, obviously, it will take money, but it will also take effort and possibly your own time and input, etc., to make the person become self-sufficient. It was a very, very tough position to sell in the non-Jewish world. Except when you think about it, this is absolutely makes perfect sense. Because the greatest level of tzedakah, I can't call this charity. This is helping another person in the end to become self-supporting. And that is the highest level of tzedakah. So again, the question will be, what about supporting the local charity? What do you do when you have people collecting from Eretz Yisrael? Or from wherever, from Brooklyn, or from all different places. You'll see at the bottom here, the list. I'm not going to go through the sources. First thing, charity begins at home. That's a famous phrase. the relatives. If you have relatives in need, that becomes, according to all the rabbis, your first priority. If you've got relatives not living in your home, that's priority number two. If you're in a poor family, poor parents come before poor children. You should make sure that one's parents, if they need help, they should be helped. Okay, there's no, absolutely no pressure on my daughter sitting in the back row over there. On the next page, poor siblings come before poor relatives. After relatives, the poorer one's neighborhood. In other words, you can see that it's going out from the center, right? And you're essentially concentrating on your local circumstance. Then the poor of one's town are equal in status to the poor of Israel. Finally, when you've got a situation where it's either the local yeshiva or the yeshiva in Israel, then that already becomes something which, you know, you'll just have to, maybe you'll split the money, whatever you'll decide to do. And then the interesting thing, I put a star against it, is that one has to consider the non-Jewish poor as well. Right? If you get two people standing at the door, one's collecting for, I don't know what they have in this country, Oxfam. I don't know if you have that. You probably do. Oh, it's all in the news at the moment, Oxfam. It's an organization collecting for, you know, people in Africa, whatever. Sorry, I don't know what it is. Salvation Army, whatever. Or you've got the guy from the local yeshiva. Then one has to be aware of the fact that as Jews, we've always had that awareness and reputation to support the non-Jewish world. Of course, the problem today with Jewish philanthropy, without going on too much on tape about it, is the fact that there are many, many Jews who don't feel the obligation towards the Jewish community, but give literally millions and millions towards the general community. Not that that's a terrible thing, on the contrary. So many Jews, you look at the hospitals in New York, every hospital has got name after name after name of different areas of the hospitals being donated and sponsored by, you know, X, Y, and Z. But the reality of it is that, you know, sometimes one would hope that the philanthropy of well-meaning people would come towards the Jewish community as well. There's a famous, I always tell this story, and if I've told it before, I apologize, the famous philanthropist in England called Isaac Wolfson, who was well-known. He gave a lot of money to Oxford and Cambridge. He did give a lot of money to the Jewish community. He was the head of the Jewish organization, United Synagogue. He was a very special guy, a bit rough around the edges, as they say. So one day, he's got an invitation to go to Oxford. He's getting a degree. He's being awarded an honorary degree. So people were joking with him and said, Sir Isaac, he became a sir. Sir Isaac, why are you getting this honorary degree? So he said, I'm getting it for writing. So they looked at him and said, we didn't know you wrote. He said, yeah, I write checks. That's what I do. That's a great story. And that's the point, you know, but at least he wrote checks, not only that for them, but he did write checks. The Gates of Yeshiva, his brother, is one of the big, big philanthropists who really got the whole Gates of Yeshiva on a good, solid footing many, many years ago, Charles Wolfson. So they're a very, very interesting family. Medical issues, and again, I'm just throwing this out and showing you how we deal with certain things in terms of Gemaras. Now have a look at this, because this Gemara in the middle of the fourth page, fourth side, is the crucial Gemara. And this is really what we're going to focus on just for a few minutes. Famous, famous Gemara. I think many of you might have seen this before, certainly heard of it before. Shnayim shehu malchim b'derech. Two people walking along the way. Ubiyadecha mehem kiton shamayim. One of them's got a bottle of water. And they're in the desert. Im shotim shneim meitim. If they both drink half a bottle, what's going to happen? They run out of water. They're both going to die. There's no way it's going to be avoided. But im shoteh chad mehem. One of them drinks the water and saves it. You know, manages to go further. Magia li yishuv. They know that he will get to a place where he will survive. Definitely, two people will not survive. One person will survive. What do you do? There's an argument. Darash ben Petura. There's a rabbi called Ben Petura. We don't know his first name. So-and-so, the son of Petura. Usually it's Shimon. If their first name is not there, it's usually Shimon, but we're not told. Ben Petura, one of the rabbis said, he said, it's very surprising. He says, Mutav she'ishdu shneim v'yom mutu. Better to divide the water between the both of them. Mm-hmm. You know what? Nebuch, it's going to happen that they won't survive. The al yirechad behem mehem b'mitato shel chaviro. And one should not witness the death of the other. Because what's going to happen is, if one drinks and the other one doesn't, the other one's going to die, the first one's going to have to watch it, it's not going to be pleasant. Says the Gemara, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva disagreed. He said that the Limeid, Rabbi Akiva, taught the following principle. V'chei ochicha imoch. It says that your brother should live with you. What does that mean? That's the verse of the Torah. Chayecha kodmin l'chayech chavercha. If you've got the bottle of water, you come first. Wow. That means you drink the water and you survive. The other guy, what will be, will be. So there's two points of view here. And this is where one gets into a very, very interesting, I would call it hashkafic, if that's the word, a discussion about hashkafah, the view, Jewish view about these two situations, or these two gentlemen. Because if you think about it, and this really is the crux of what this Gemara is teaching us, how do we view this crisis? Do we view this crisis, let's call it in the short term, or let's talk about it in the long term? All right. Now, what do I mean? I mean like this. In the short term, we know that one person will drink the water. What will happen? He will survive. Reuven. Reuven has the water. He drinks it. He will survive. Shimon doesn't have the water. He won't drink it. He won't survive. So what happens is, in such a case, says Rabbi Akiva, Reuven drinks the water, survives. Shimon doesn't. So what we're basically saying, according to Rabbi Akiva, one of the great, great rabbis of all time, he says that we've got to take what one can only describe as a short-term view. Right? That's his policy. His policy is, look at the now, and don't worry about the future. The now is that one, Reuven will have the water, Shimon will not have the water, and kesara sara, what will be. Ben Petura, who's obviously a very valid gentleman of the Talmudic period, he turns around and says, no. He says, I can't come to terms with one person having to go through the experience of watching his friend die. He says, what we've got to take is a long-term view. In the long term, you know what? And now we're going to divide the water 50-50. And Reuven drinks a little bit, and Shimon drinks a little bit. That's for today. What will happen tomorrow, looking further down the line, who knows? Maybe there'll be a caravan coming across the desert like Lawrence of Arabia, if you ever saw the movie, that wonderful scene at the beginning, the whole caravan of camels coming across the desert, and the next thing you know, they're both saved. Maybe in 2 days' time, there'll be an aeroplane flying over one of these, over the desert, and they'll be found, right? Who knows? They're in a boat. Maybe someone will find the lifeboat. They will find the person. Who knows? But Ben Petura says he can't agree with Rabbi Akiva that we look at the now, but he says, on the contrary, what we have to do is to look at the future. I hope that makes sense, the two different hashkafot, two different points of view. Yeah?
In light of this, Masada, always used to be a place where they would gather for all these famous meat. Now, not so much, because they don't ascribe to that suicidal view.
Correct. The suicidal view is, and that's something which I'm avoiding in this shiur, because that is a whole shiur by itself. All right. The whole question in the Middle Ages of whether giving up your life for the religion under those circumstances, right, was actually condoned by rabbinic tradition or not. Right, and there is a very strong comment from one of the Tosfot in the.
So you mean even Kiddush Hashem?
Even in situation of Kiddush Hashem, there's a whole story of Rav Lau. Rav Lau's father wrote a book about Kiddush Hashem. He died on Kiddush. He was killed by the Nazis, and he sent a page of this sefer to one of the rabbis in Israel, who produced the page after the war when the boys came out of Buchenwald and they got to Israel. The two brothers, they went to see this Rav, who they knew had known their father, and he says, "Here's a page of your father's book." And of course, that was overwhelming for them, you can imagine. And that page, on the page, it was all about Kiddush Hashem and the parameters of Kiddush Hashem. That needs a whole shiur by itself, another time, mm-hmm. All right? Because I can't go through that now.
Make it back to K.
If we go through this again. We'll see. We'll see how to work out how it goes. Look what I wrote at the end here, at the bottom of this second section. The definite outweighs the doubtful, right? If you're sure, for instance, in a medical situation, that you've got two people waiting for a kidney, God forbid, in a very difficult circumstance, and one person has got more chance than the other, you may very well turn around and say, Bori Vashem, the Gemara says, if something is clear, the other one is doubtful, then you always go for the obvious, you always go for the better situation. And that is another way of determining criteria between two situations, like the the difference of Ben Patur and Rabbi Akiva would be also, someone's waiting for a kidney, do you look in the short term, or do you look in the long term? Who's got a longer term chance of survival, or who has got a better short term chance of survival? You know, doctors have to make these kind of decisions, you know, almost on a daily basis. And it must be incredibly difficult. I know it is difficult, right, to decide who gets the limited resource of the donor organ or whatever it may be. I have to mention, I heard a shift from Dr. Rosner, who I think is still around, or certainly his son is still around in Eretz Yisrael. Shalom Rosner is a really, really fine rabbi in the Yeshivot in Israel. Dr. Rosner said that he was told by Ramosha Feinstein that when the Sanhedrin comes along, please God, Mashiach comes, we get a Sanhedrin, they have to make their first priority that every single Jew in Israel, at least, carries a donor card, which is a very interesting thing. And he said the reason is because there's no question about it, with the technology that we have today, and this was 30 years ago, so even more so now, that is going to save lives. We're worried about Tchias HaMesim, and people have all these sort of things about, you know, worried about the body not quite being intact or whatever. All of that, you know, one puts to one side, because if by giving an organ, God forbid, under those circumstances, it can save another life, that far outweighs, that's the ultimate criteria, pikuach nefesh, or whatever you want to call it, and there's no question that donor cards would be, according to Dr. Rosner, he said this, he was told that would be the first, almost the first thing Sanhedrin would do, right? I would imagine one before that they might deal with second day Yontov in Chusla Aretz, I'd like to think. But that will be a separate discussion. I think the donor card is more important than the second day Yontov. But anyway, go over to the third page, because this is the one that I really want to just get to. And on the basis of what we saw just now, we can come out with an amazing conclusion. The situation is like this, and we're in a Cherry Hill circumstance. You can correct me if I'm wrong. There was what was it, 10 years ago, the library? When was it, 10 years ago? Not even. Right, and there was a big to-do about the Cherry Hill Library. It was, what, $20 million?
13 years ago.
13, right?
And it was upset that it wasn't on the east side.
And that was what upset people. But, you know, I heard it in terms of, you know, how could so much money go for a library? What would we say as Jews? You've got someone who wants to give $20 million, and the choices are to build a hospital. And we're talking here where you've got already a hospital in the neighborhood. All right, thank God here we're on top of very... If you're not... You know, you're not going to be so happy about the local hospital, then thank God in Philadelphia you've got phenomenal hospitals. You know, we're really blessed with that. But another hospital that will save lives. Or the library, right? Which doesn't save lives, but, you know, has within it the potential for developing communal resources and bettering the lives of people in terms of, like we said before with Stakar, helping them to become more self-sufficient. The library, you know, you see a lot of people there, they're researching the whole day. What would be our voice? What would be our opinion on this? And, you know, you would say to me, well, of course it's Pekod Nefesh. Obviously, it's about saving lives. Listen to this Gemara, because with this Gemara that we're going to read now, and what we just saw with Ben Patur and Rabbi Akiva, which is not really... an argument, one is right and one is wrong. They've got two different viewpoints. If you think about it, Ben Patur is saying, I'm taking the long-term view. Rabbi Akiva said, I'm taking the short-term view. We'll come back to that in a minute, but look at this Gemara. It's Gemara in the Dorim. It's on the third page, and I'm just going to share this with you, because this, again, is a great surprise.
I'm going to lock up. We just have to close the lights.
Right. Okay. Look at this. The third Gemara, the third page, this last Gemara, and then we're finished. Mayan shel b'nei ha'ir. You've got one source of water in a city, right? Like the old days, not like today. And chayem v'chayei acherim. And it can provide life for you or for other people, maybe from the outside. So who comes first? Chayem kodmin l'chayei acherim. You come first. You're living in the city. There's the water which is coming in, like Yerushalayim. It had its own source of water. You have to give water to the people living in Jerusalem. Behemtan ubehemat achirim. What happens if it's water not for the lives of the individuals but for the animals? There's enough water for your animals or for the animals of others. Who comes first? Then it says behemtan kodemet lebehemat achirim. Your animals come first. Here comes the amazing concept. Kvisatan kvisat achirim. It's not talking about water that's going to be crucial in terms of saving lives, but It's the extra water you need to do the laundry. What's the law? Who comes first? Who gets the use of the water? So he tells you, Kvisatan kodemet kvisat achirim. Your laundry needs in the city come before the person or the group of people from the outside. Now listen to this. Chayei achirim ukvisatan. You've got enough water that for the other people out there would keep them alive. But if you use the water in the city, it's going to be good. You've got enough water to drink, but it would help you to keep your clothes clean. Who gets the use of that water? Right, I hope that's clear. That's the choice between giving it to people outside the city to drink or for you to use for laundry. Says the Gemara, surprisingly, two opinions as always, but listen to this. The first opinion is probably what we'd all say. Of course you give the water to the other people because they need it to drink. Rabbi Yossi, oh man. Rabbi Yossi says, no, you've got more pressing needs. You know what it is? Kvisatan kodemet l'chayachirim. You've got to do your laundry. You've got to keep your clothes clean. Why? Because if you don't keep your clothes clean, God forbid, it generates who knows what sort of lice and typhus and all the rest of it. Lo aleinu, you have a plague on your hands. Now, it may not happen overnight, but certainly this is an opinion which is saying that in this kind of situation, it's not the obvious decision that you make. You've got to take, not as we're calling the opinion of Rabbi Akiva, the short-term view. Sometimes I think this Gemara fits in very nicely, or fits in very well with the idea of a long-term view. The short-term solution for the other people is to give them the water because they haven't got enough water if they're in another place. But the long-term situation for you in the city is if you don't use the water to do your laundry, eventually, God forbid, there's going to be plague and going to be who knows what's going to happen. And that can affect the people, not tomorrow, won't be next week, but in the course of maybe a few weeks or months, there's going to be real issues, health issues within the city. Says Rabbi Yossi that you worry about the laundry in your city before you give the water to the people outside to drink. Extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. And the Hamek She'ela, the Tziv, the famous rabbi of Volozhin, talks about it. And he basically says, he links this whole discussion with the whole thing we said before between Rabbi Akiva and Ben Patura. And he says Ben Patura's view is Rabbi Yossi's view. His view is that we don't necessarily go for the immediate question, we look at a longer term picture. What is this city going to look like in 6 months? Is it going to be a place where people are still going to be alive, people are going to be healthy, or are we going to say, in 6 months, if we don't do the laundry, we've just got enough water to sort of supply people with that, and there's a drought going on, or whatever it is, the reality of it is, it would be better to do that to keep our city alive, even though the other people need it for drinking. I'm not going to worry about them, I have to worry about what's going on here. Says Rabbi Naftali Tzviyud of Berlin, that becomes a consideration, surprisingly, because we would have thought, if it's a question of life and death, you give the water to the people out there. You don't sort of hold on to the water yourself. We see that that's not always going to be the case. Back to the Cherry Hill Library. Back to any library. Back to any park. Back to any development, open spaces. The beautiful thing, Teddy Kollek, the famous mayor of Jerusalem, right, was not a religious man. But why has he been, as far as I'm concerned, he's got a little place up there in Olam Haba because he turned Yerushalayim into a beautiful place. He put all of those verges, the flowers in the middle of by the Knesset, as you drive along all those wonderful open boulevards and whatever. That was Teddy Kollek. Before that, it was rubble. It really was not anything more. You're right, Jerusalem was Jerusalem. But he had this tremendous sense that on the ground, you've got to have this sense of beauty, because Jerusalem has to radiate, it has to shine with the physical presence of God's creation, if you want to put it like that. And that was Kollek, and it's something which ever since then has always been one of the great features of Yerushalayim. The very fact you go there and you say, wow, this is a magnificent place, it's so beautiful. And it's not a, how should we say, it's not against Jewish tradition to have such a point of view. It turns out that, you know, if we're in a situation where we may argue that for the benefit of society, building that library is going in the long term, not in the short term. The short term, the hospital will save lives. You get the hospital built 2 months, 3 months, and you've saved lives. But that may not necessarily be the ultimate viewpoint, if you're looking in more of a long-term, Ben Pateras style situation, and you'll say to yourself, long-term, maybe the development, you build a theater, you build a library, you have an infrastructure, social infrastructure, that all takes resources, but at the same time, what an investment in the community for the future. And in Israel, I know that they are very concerned about this, that many, many new cities do really try their best to have this kind of aesthetic view when you come into the city. I know Beit Shemesh have been trying sort of very hard, Modi'in, all the new towns that you go and visit, they've all sort of been aware of this. And I think that it's interesting to see from the way that the Gemara is explained by Rabbi Berlin that it's not treif, it's not against our tradition to have that kind of point of view. And it's a surprise. As I said at the beginning, it came, certainly when I heard this the first time, I was very shocked. I thought to myself, there's no question, of course you build a hospital, and you have a library, okay, that's a luxury. It turns out it's not such a luxury, and having a theatre is not such a luxury, right? There are, you can develop some kind of within cities, you know, you have a certain identity that comes from these social interactions that take place, be it in the sort of, you know, communal space or wherever it may be. And that, I think, is something which, as Jews, we are aware of. And that, I think, is important. If anything comes out of this Shiur, the Simeon, as I said, it's this awareness that we have a much broader view about how to allocate resources in terms of city planning, town planning, than maybe we realize.
Just a quick question. I'm sorry. Could you extrapolate from, like, I forgot which Gemara it is, whatever, that it's, is it more important, let's say, if you're living in a community, to give your tzedakah within that community than elsewhere? I'm not saying you shouldn't give elsewhere, but what I'm saying is if you're...
And that's what we did say. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Your community comes first.
Okay.
Yeah, we did say that. And that, I think, is again part of what we're saying here, is that there is this focus that once you've established communities, once you're living in a communal structure, then part of, if not the main focus of your resources should be to develop and, you know, so we're not doing so bad developing the shul, putting in new furniture is not, from this point of view, is an investment down the line in the future of the community. There's no question in my mind about that. All right, it may have been controversial. It may, have, you know, I, we're really living this particular subject, you know, at the moment, and it is using a communal resource, and you know, having all the arguments about whether it should have gone for this or gone for that or whatever. The reality of it is, you know, we can see that, and Chazal, I think here give us a breadth of view which is really quite refreshing, right? It's not what I expected to read. It's not saying, well, it's always because Nefesh and it's another hospital and that's it. It's not always going to be like that.
And the Rabbi
and the Chazan is great. We should never be in that position. We have to make the choice. I've been very careful what I say because it's going on tape. This is not a new problem. This is an old problem. And there have been many Dine Torah about all of this as well, which I don't even want to go into. Bottom line is that if you're not sure, first come, first serve. If you are in a bigger picture, not necessarily looking on the individual level where first come, first serve would apply, but a bigger picture, like a communal decision of use of resources, then there is room to say, to argue that the communal demand may not necessarily be an immediate your investment may not show an immediate return, but as a long-term investment, a long-term view of the community, it would be certainly within our consideration to use those resources for a library, for whatever the community needs, which is beyond its obvious immediate requirements. It's quite interesting. There is an interesting development in England. The Hasidim, who were living in a neighborhood in London, Stamford Hill, they never left there, have finally, after sort of being there since the Hungarians came in 56, and that's when the Hasidic community really grew over there, they're moving out of London. They're finally moving.
Where are they going?
And a place on the coast, there's a coastal community which is embracing them, and it's a very interesting development, and part of what they're doing, very smart, is they're adopting Ben Pateras. They're actually going with the idea that not only do we buy houses in this community, we have to develop infrastructure within the community. They're trying, even to the point where the local non-Jewish community is trying to sort of build a relationship with the Hasidic Jews, which is going to be incredibly difficult, because generally Hasidic Jews don't have that kind of interaction with the people around them in the way that we would expect. But it's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. There's actually a YouTube film, what's been going on there, and part of the development is the infrastructure, right? Not just the yeshiva and the shul and the whatever, you know, they're bringing stores, they're bringing things that the community needs in a more general sense. Fascinating. And I think it's being done by people who really do get this particular discussion that we've had, right? And that's not, it's not easy. You have
why,
to stand.
Why are they moving out of
the because it's so, too expensive. It's like, the property like costs are, it's like Borough Park, and it's even
very
not,
crowded.
It's not because,
even worse.
It's not because of migration.
No. It's really, they need more space, large families living in impossibly difficult conditions. It's happening in Israel. Mesh Arim style is just not working anymore for so many of the families that they have to move to more space. They realize living in a small space with lots of people just doesn't work. It really creates a lot of social issues, and one doesn't hear of half of what's going on over there, and I'm glad we don't. Bottom line, triage, very, very challenging, very interesting, and as always, as we keep saying over and over again, there is room to have the discussion with the rabbi, not only with the town planner, not only with the doctor, but include the rabbi in the discussion, because there is what to say from a Jewish perspective. It may even surprise you what he says, right? And I think that's worth knowing. That is really worth knowing. Please.
You mentioned that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was for giving organs.
Yes, yeah, the so organ donation. Yeah.
So it's like...
He, at the time, same thing. There is now an Orthodox, I forgot what they call themselves, Hebrew, what they call it? It's an Orthodox organization for people to go on a register for donor, to donate organs, God forbid, in a situation. Of course, the problem is, it's another shiur about the definition of death, right? You can't, the organ will not be good if the person's heart has stopped. But if the heart's going, but the brain is dead, right, then Rabbi Tendler, who's Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law, is still alive, he's in his 90s, in Monsey, New York. He's got a very strong opinion about this. Rabbi Bleich from Yeshiva University disagrees with him. And to this day, this is a very big, big debate amongst the rabbis, the more medical inclined rabbis, as to what's allowed, what's not allowed. There's a very sad but very comforting story in Eretz Yisrael. There was a young man, Yoni Jesner, and I knew the family from Scotland. And he was learning in yeshiva in Gush Etzion, and he was on a bus in Tel Aviv, Nebuchadnezzar, and he was basically in the hospital. He wasn't going to survive. And the parents, as always, so distraught, but they were told by the hospital, he's got organs to donate. Are you prepared to donate them? So the initial response, after much discussion, is yes. And then they said, but it's to an Arab. Are you prepared to donate it to an Arab? And he said, yes.
Good.
Yes, they did. They donated to Aram.
It's a big Kiddush Hashem.
And it was a big Kiddush. It was an unbelievable story. Wow. And it comes as a shock. It came when I read this, and the Arab family, you know, what would you do? And God forbid you never, ever be in that circumstance, but it's an unbelievable story. Happened about 10, 12 years ago. Did they appreciate? Did they know? In this case, I'm sure it did. What can I say? We should never be tested by this, but these are real live situations. I thank everybody for coming out. Have a wonderful Purim. Excellent Purim. I don't know the choices between staying sober or not. There's no triage in this case. You definitely stay with the drink. And Mirat Hashem, the next year, we'll send out a note to say when it will be. And please God, we should always be together on these types of occasions. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.